Good afternoon.
My name is Bill Lawrence. I'm the dean at Perkins School of Theology, and I am honored and delighted to welcome you to this afternoon's Faith and Business Luncheon. We have a wonderful program planned. It is not my intention at all to interrupt your lunch, so please continue eating. And in just a few minutes, we're actually going to say thanks to God for the food that you will have continued to enjoy while our conversation is going on. It is my honor this afternoon not only to stand here and welcome you, but also to introduce to you some very special people whose presence and participation in this Faith and Business Luncheon makes it an extraordinary event for all of us. Let me begin by asking a couple of people to stand. They are Philip and Holly Philbin. They're right over here. They are the sponsors of today's luncheon. Holly's grandmother, Elizabeth Perkins Prothro, is the person whose name is on this building, and we dedicated it in honor and, as it happened, in memory of Mrs. Prothro last September. We are also grateful not only to Holly and to Philip, but to the Prothro Foundation for their support and sponsorship of this luncheon. There's some other persons in the room that are special guests. We have one member of the Board of Trustees at SMU. I'm going to introduce him to you in a bit, so let me pass that. There is one SMU trustee spouse in the room. That's Jan Hagee, wife of Fred Hagee. Jan, if you would wave to the group and say hello. We also have some members of the Executive Board of Perkins School of Theology in the room. I'm going to ask them stand and then remain standing until I've introduced all of them. They include Judy Gibbs, Dodie Crockett, whose idea originated this event, David Dunnigan, Don Winspear, who may or may not have arrived yet, Catherine Glaze Lyle, and Linda Roby. If you would all greet these members of the Perkins Executive Board. In addition to these persons, I want you to welcome a member of the Campaign Steering Committee for Perkins School of Theology. He's seated over here at Talmadge Boston. And by the way, Talmadge's life is complete now that baseball season has begun again. There are several members of the Perkins School of Theology faculty and staff. I'm not going to try to call all your names as I stand here and scout the room, but if you are a member of the Perkins faculty or staff, please stand where you are. As you can tell, an awful lot of them clumped together back at that table over there. We also have, I believe, three Perkins students here in the room. Let me call their names and ask them to stand and remain standing. Ernest Bryson, Amelia Petersey, and Brenda Brooks. Four Perkins students, right. Now I'm going to call on Brenda to lead us in prayer and to offer thanksgiving as an invocation for our Faith and Business Luncheon together.
Let us pray. Eternal and gracious God, we give you thanks for this day. We thank you for this food that has been prepared for us. We thank you for providing us with this opportunity to share the tensions of faith, of our faith in business. Continue now to be with us as we ponder the possibilities within the promises of our faith. Bless the leaders of this endeavor. Give us all attentive ears and listening hearts, that we may speak boldly to matters that would silence our faith. Continue to nurture us through your prophets and through your Son, now and forevermore. In the name of the one that loves us all, we pray. Amen.
Thank you very much.
And now I want to invite to come forward one of the persons whom you've already greeted. The Reverend Catherine Glaze Lyle is a member of the Perkins Executive Board and our Campaign Steering Committee. Catherine is one of the individuals who has been, from the earliest days of discussion about faith and business luncheons, very supportive of this concept and directly involved. Catherine is going to share with you a little bit of information about this project and about what lies ahead. Please join me in welcoming Catherine Glaze Lyle.
Probably for most people in Dallas, if they were asked what Perkins School of Theology does, they would say, well, it trains Methodist pastors. But the reality is much deeper and broader than that, as Perkins does have a mission of preparing men and women for leadership in the church, but that doesn't mean just clergy leadership. And it doesn't mean just professional leadership. The faith and business luncheons are an expression of that deeper and broader meaning to our mission as we seek to help in an academic setting to provide a place for critical reflection on the intersection of our own private faiths, our own deep personal faith, and our lives as a part of a community here in Dallas, that and where in ways that our faith gets expressed through a variety of different occupations and professions. All that has been going on here at Perkins since 1943, but the Faith and Business Luncheon started last year. So this is a relatively new way that we have chosen to engage both the community that is here at Perkins as a professional academic community, the students who are here, some of us who are pastors, and some of you folk who are members of churches of a lot of different denominations. We are excited to have these luncheons. This is our third here at the school. We had one with an outside speaker who we brought in to present a luncheon and a speech on Abraham Lincoln. But we've had three here in this setting, and I am deeply touched that Maureen Dickey, who was our speaker at the second luncheon, is here today. And I take that as a real, I think that says a lot about her, but I think it also must say something about what she experienced here and the quality of conversation that occurred to make her want to come back today. So I'm very thrilled that she's here today. There are two more planned for this calendar year. There will be another luncheon in September and another luncheon in November. Those dates are not finalized yet, but if you'll make sure that you leave us contact information, we'll be in touch with you and let you know about those dates when they are set. Somebody asked me today if I'd been to all these, and I said yes, and they're just wonderful. Each time, there just are such riches that you gain. So it's been a joy to be here. I encourage you to come back and to engage with Perkins in whatever way is appropriate for you, because we want to engage in the broadest sense that we can, to because we are so committed to this mission that we have of engaging in a search for those meaningful intersections between our individual lives and the life of our community. It's really a joy to have you here today. We're glad to glad to have this time together. Bill?
Thank you, Catherine. Now I want to introduce to you the two persons who are going to be our speakers for the day. I'm going to introduce both of them now and then not interrupt their presentations. I'll introduce them in the order in which they are going to speak. And by the way, if you want to find your way back over there, I see a few cookies and brownies still lingering. Please save one cookie or one brownie for me. I haven't been to the food table yet. But do feel free to continue to enjoy your lunch. Allow me to introduce the extraordinary people who are going to be speaking to us today. The first one to talk is Mike Boone. Mike is a member of the board of directors of Haynes and Boone and one of the co-founders of that distinguished firm. He has more than 40 years experience in mergers and acquisitions, corporate finance, securities transactions, and board of director representations. He has been selected as the go-to lawyer in Texas in the field of corporate and business law by Texas Lawyer Magazine, one of the top corporate finance mergers and acquisitions lawyers in Dallas by D Magazine, and one of the top 10 super lawyers by Texas Monthly and Law and Politics Magazine. Mike is an extraordinary professional in terms of his achievement in the fields of law that I've just listed. But even more than that, Mike is an extraordinary servant of the community. I've come to know him through these last 8.5 years as a member of the staff of Southern Methodist University and as dean at Perkins School of Theology. Mike is a member of the Board of Trustees. He is an active participant in the life of this university and a devoted supporter of all of the schools of the university, including this one. Now, I will say that I think part of his devotion to Perkins School of Theology is to make sure, as a faithful member of the Church of Christ, that United Methodists like me don't stray too far from the truth. And every once in a while, I have an opportunity to check on Mike and whether his sacramental theology is approaching somewhere close to truth. But that's another conversation for another day in another setting. The truth is that to have a person of deep faith, of extraordinary professional achievement, and outstanding service to the university and the community like Mike as a friend and as a trustee of this university means that we as a school of theology and as Southern Methodist University are in great hands. Mike has lent his time to us in a number of ways by volunteering his expertise in some preliminary conversations that we have had, for example, around the topic of developing what we hope will be a center for religious leadership here at Perkins School of Theology. Mike has been an early conversation partner in these endeavors, and I'm very grateful to him. So I know that you want to join me in welcoming Mike as one of the two speakers who is going to lead us today. The second person who will speak to us immediately following Mike is an assistant professor of Old Testament here at Perkins School of Theology. Dr. Suzanne Schultz joined the faculty not very long ago and has had an amazing background. She is a native of Germany. She began her education there and then came to the United States, completed her PhD at Union Theological Seminary in New York. She has taught in an amazing variety of places, including the Chinese University of Hong Kong, an institution that I had the privilege to visit some 15 months ago. And her connections with the faculty and the staff at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, the Divinity School of Chinese University of Hong Kong, remain quite strong. Because of her own international scholarly connections and her own international background, Suzanne has become recognized at a very early phase of her career as really one of the premier global scholars in Old Testament studies. And I have to tell you that when she came here for an interview, I was tremendously impressed with the breadth as well as the depth of the scholarship that was reflected in her initial lecture to us, where she was able to offer an interpretation of the first couple of chapters of the book of Genesis that reflected a feminist critique of those passages, then an evangelical critique of the feminist critique, then a feminist re-critique of the evangelical critique. Anybody who can do that with that much breadth is an accomplished intellectual, a person who understands the power and the depth of faith, and somebody who is in our midst, making a tremendous contribution as a member of our faculty. The final thing I will tell you about her is that just within the last 2 weeks, she has received word from the provost of Southern Methodist University that he will be recommending her to the president of the university and to the board of trustees for promotion in rank to associate professor and the award of tenure at Southern Methodist University. So you will be hearing first from Mike Boone and second from Suzanne Schultz. Now, I have a task before you begin. I have the honor of presenting to you a copy of Introducing the Women's Hebrew Bible by your colleague today, good. Suzanne Schultz.
Great. Thank you.
And it's already signed, so you have to keep it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I think you're already Mike.
Yeah, I've already. When we met for breakfast, and I used the word Old Testament only once. And then I remembered I need to use the word Hebrew Bible. You're a very good instructor. I learned quickly. Thank you for inviting me to speak to you today. This is an important subject for me because I've always thought a great deal about the issue of how you connect to your faith and especially how you deal with the spiritual tensions that can arise and the conflicts that arise between the two. I was interested, though, that I, and perhaps some of you are wondering why I would be inviting a lawyer being invited to talk about Christianity. To many, you know, it's a it's an oxymoron for there to be a Christian lawyer. And in fact, there's a book even written. It's entitled "Can a Good Christian Be a Good Lawyer?" And obviously, there's an issue about, you know, lawyer status as being good Christians or not. I Googled just to find out if there was any similar books entitled "Can You Be a Good Dentist and Be a Good Christian?" And then I did "Can You Be a Good Doctor and Be a Christian?" And, you know, I found out there are no books like that. So the thing that I hesitated and stayed away from, I was afraid to look for a book entitled "Can a Good Used Car Salesman Be a Good Christian?" And the reason I didn't do that because I was afraid I would not find one. So anyway, I concluded that I must have been invited here on the basis that I am known to have been active in representing corporate America, and there's a general perception out there that corporate America is full of corrupt people and money-hungry people, and so I finally concluded the other night I must have been invited on the basis on the theory that it takes one to know one. So I'm going to talk from experiences in that regard, but let me ask you to do one thing. I thought about this, and I want to make sure I put this on the record, that you think about this when I talk, because I'm going to talk about things that I think are important, but I want you to know that I do not claim to have mastered the spiritual challenges of the workplace. To the contrary, I have often failed to be the person that Christ calls me to be in the workplace. And I have identified many times with the frustrations that Paul talks about in Romans 7 about his struggles to follow after Christ. So please know that you need to put an asterisk on some of the things I say that may imply that I think I'm doing everything right. Before I begin, let me just give you one thought that's important, just background. I was raised in a Christian home. I was blessed to have great parents, and they believe very strongly in what we're told in Scripture, raise up a child when he is young, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. I got close. And the bottom line is it was instilled in me early on the importance of being faithful to God. And I have to admit, I entered this whole arena of business with that in the back of my mind as a challenge. Is could I honor my parents? Could I honor God by making sure that I didn't fall by the wayside, that I kept my faith in God and I did what pleased God and didn't get off the track? So I owe all of this to my parents and my relationship to God. My work as a lawyer, though, I'm going to say, has impacted my thoughts about how I think Christians should approach the workplace. I have found that at least I believe I'm at my best when I really prepare myself for what I'm about to do, when I really sit down and think about the issues in advance and study them, when I study the opposition, and when I prepare myself for the what if. What if this happens during this transaction or during this event? What am I going to do? How am I going to react? So I have to do a lot of those questions, a lot like about preparation. But clearly, I feel it essential that to be a good lawyer, you have to have a great game plan in hand that you've really thought through carefully before you ever enter the courtroom or enter the boardroom. And I think the same principle applies to us as we strive to be authentic Christians in the marketplace. We cannot expect spiritual success if we have not first carefully considered the challenges of the workplace and that we have also prepared ourselves for the workplace. That requires spiritual thinking, it requires spiritual resolve, and it requires spiritual discipline on our part. Paul is quite clear about this when he says, we're all familiar with this, train yourself to be godly. And then he writes in other places that he had to learn how to be a follower of Christ, to adhere to what Christ calls us to be. It takes effort. And in a similar vein, Peter tells us to make every effort to maintain self-control and to persevere in our life. The point to me is simply this. Being an authentic Christian in the workplace is hard. It's hard to do. It requires determined effort on our part. It requires concentration on our part if we are to achieve that end. Having said that, I have spent thinking about what spiritual factors impact me the most. And I thought about it. I made this presentation before in a different way. This time I thought about it, I'd come at it a different way. Thought about what is it that I have thought about that put a state of the mind awareness of who I was to be in the workplace that would make a difference in achieving in meeting the spiritual challenges of the workplace. And let me just say that I've studied and looked at about six factors that I think are relevant to me. They've helped shaped my thoughts about how you connect faith with your work. And I've thought about those, and I want to talk about those this afternoon. But I also want to mention before I do that there is a great importance that we have a state of the mind awareness of what we're all about, what our game plan is for the workplace from a spiritual perspective. If you have a spiritual mindset about these things, when you go into the marketplace, then you can deal with them effectively. If they're not in the forefront of your mind, you're not thinking about them, then you're vulnerable. So I've thought about how I keep myself disciplined on that, and I have, just like any of you, the spiritual disciplines. But it's important to remember what we're about in the workplace. So let me share with you basically six spiritual factors that have impacted me and that have helped me be spiritually oriented in the marketplace, and I think make a difference for us dealing with the marketplace. The first one is we need to always be mindful that our work has a spiritual purpose. When you think that, you realize that, it makes a whole difference. Paul says in Colossians 3, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for men. For it is the Lord Christ Jesus that you are serving. God wants us to enter the marketplace with the understanding that our work has a spiritual purpose. Thankfully, I learned a long time ago that God did not send Mike Boone to this earth with the assigned purpose of seeing how much money, how much fame, and how much power I could garner during my life. No, I thankfully was taught by my parents that our business careers, what we do in our life, is for much loftier purposes. They're for God's purposes. So, Blues Brothers, I don't want to be sacrilegious there. We should be saying to ourselves every day that we head off to work, we're on a mission from God, because that's what we are. We're on a mission from God. When you think about it, that is a very energizing and exciting thought to have when you enter the workplace. Our work takes on a greater significance and meaning when we fully grasp the thought that we're on a mission from God when we go to work. The second spiritual thought or spiritual factor that I've focused on is we need to always be mindful that the workplace is full of spiritual opportunities and full of spiritual risk for us. There are two primary reasons why I believe our business careers are important to God. The first one, He wants us to use the talents He has given us to be the very best we can be, not for selfish or prideful reasons, but for His purposes. Second, He sends us in the marketplace to be light and salt. Now, why is that true? Well, I believe that's because that's where all the action is. That is where the world and you and I go every day, every workday, to conduct business. And that is also where Satan goes to conduct his affairs. After all, the problems of self-centeredness, greed, all the things you can think of that we know that are problems in the workplace, they thrive there to Satan's advantage. Arguably, there is no single place that affords Christians greater spiritual opportunities to serve God than does the marketplace. As His ambassadors, we are there to serve the spiritual and physical needs of others in the marketplace. And just as importantly, and sometimes overlooked, we are there to be a positive influence on the way our society and our governments and our businesses conduct themselves. But God wants us to be aware that there's also spiritual risk to be reckoned with when we go in the workplace. The business world is full of spiritual traps for Christians. We face moral dilemmas that tempt us to compromise our Christian principles. Moreover, our work demands can consume our time, our energy, and our thoughts to the point that we have little or no time left for God, for our families, for our church lives, or even for ourselves. The third one is we need to always be mindful that we are in the middle of a spiritual war and that Satan is our adversary. As C.S. Lewis puts it, there is no neutral territory in the universe. Every square inch, every split second is claimed by God and counterclaimed by Satan. And if there's a ground zero for this spiritual war, it surely has to be the marketplace. Peter warns us in 1 Peter 5, be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him standing in the faith. Paul gives us similar admonitions in Ephesians 6. So my mindset has always been we need to enter the workplace fully aware of the spiritual war and that Satan is a serious adversary. The important thing here is that we appreciate and be alert to Satan's schemes. He wants us to overlook him. He wants us to take him for granted, and we can never afford to do that. Rather, we need to understand his spiritual traps, his deceptive ways, and our vulnerabilities. Now, this is based on my own observation. This is my experience. You might have a different list, but these are the things that jump out at me that I most worry about, and that I see snare people all the time in the workplace. And that is Satan wants us to do one of these six things or more, to be consumed by our work so we don't have time to focus on anything. It becomes our God. We become intoxicated by our work. To live beyond our financial means so we have no freedom. We can't walk away from a problem. We have to go along to get along in the workplace because we're overextended. To make money a driving force in our lives is obviously all-consuming. He wants us to get caught up in the social status, our social status and our self-importance. All of that brings us down. He wants us to rationalize wrongdoing in business and to compartmentalize our lives into a religious one and a non-religious one. And, of course, we must avoid all those traps. As I was thinking about this matter of being prepared to consider the schemes and the traps we can fall into, I started thinking about the movie Patton starring George C. Scott. Most of you have seen it. As you recall, there is a scene in the movie that shows General Patton defeating Rommel, the great German military commander, in a battle in North Africa. Patton had long studied Rommel's military tactics. In fact, he had even read a very strong book that Rommel had written about military tactics. And in the scene in the movie, George C. Scott is seen standing on a plateau. He's overlooking the battle. He's got his binoculars up looking at this. So George comes on his face as he sees the German tanks retreat and the German forces retreat. And then he shouts out, "Rommel, you magnificent blankety blank, I read your book." Well, I'm going to take that over to this application. I think we should aspire one day to say, "Satan, you magnificent so-and-so, I read the Bible. I knew about you. I knew what I had to do to fend you off." And so this is something that I think we have to take very serious. We have to enter the workplace thinking like a warrior because we're the target. We can take nothing for granted. We are all susceptible, every one of us. The fourth point that I would make is we need to always be mindful that self is our shield. We are all familiar with Christ's words in Luke 9. "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." C.S. Lewis paraphrased it this way: "Give me all. I don't want so much of your time and so much of your work. I want you. Hand over yourself." Bottom line, as followers of Christ, we are to surrender ourselves to Christ. So, like Paul, we can say, "I no longer live, but Christ lives in me." However, at least for me, I have found that managing self is still very, 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 very hard. It is in the workplace that you strive to be the best. You want to get ahead. You want to be good at what you do. You want people to accept you. All of those things can cause our selfish desires to bubble up, and self takes back over who we are and what we do and how we think. And so I have found, this is my own practice, that periodically I need to step back and do a self-examination of what I'm thinking and what I'm doing. I have choices at times. I have to make decisions. And I've got to ask myself periodically, a self-examination, am I doing this about pleasing Mike Boone, or am I doing this about pleasing God? We have to step back and do a self-examination. I think that managing self is a 24/7 job, 365 days a year, at least it is for Mike Boone. In the London subway stations, they have this little platform sign. You've seen it if you've been in London. It's about the gap between the platform and the car, the subway car. And it says, "Mind the gap." Mind the gap. And I've always thought to myself, we would do ourselves a real favor if we would have on our desk a little sign that says, "Mind the self." Because it's something we have to think about all the time. We get caught up with ourselves. We get taken away with ourselves. Once we start thinking we're the smartest guys in the room, we're in real trouble. And so dealing with this of self has been an issue for me forever. And the fifth one is this: we need to be always mindful that our moral courage can be the difference between right and wrong conduct in the marketplace. Now, I see that because I'm in corporate America. I've been to meetings where there's pushback and tough issues to make a decision, and some of them can get on the line of right or wrong. And so being brave and having the moral courage to stand up for what is right is essential to being an authentic Christian in the marketplace. Unfortunately, we sometimes succumb to the evil temptations of the workplace out of fear. But it should not be that way. God tells us over and over and over again in Scripture, "Do not be afraid. Fear not." It's the most strongest, longest theme you can find. Why? Because He is with us. He looks after us. All we have to do is trust in Him. As was told to Joshua when he faced difficult circumstances, God tells us the same thing today. Be strong and be courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. Our spiritual courage is linked directly to our present awareness of God, to our knowledge of who He is, and our placing our total trust in Him. I believe that this is the toughest issue that Christians face in the marketplace. It takes a lot of moral courage to risk our job security by drawing a line, drawing the sand in the line, a line in the sand about doing what's right as opposed to doing what's wrong. In that regard, I have drawn myself some courage from time to time by the following quote, which I want to share with you. But it relates to this issue and goes to the point of doing what's right. You have no enemies, you say? Alas, my friend, the boast is poor. He who has mingled in the fray of duty, of the duty that the brave endure, must have made foes. If you have none, small is the work that you have done. You've hit no traitor on the hip. You've dashed no cup from purged lip. You've never turned the wrong to right. You've been a coward in the fight. We can never afford to be a coward in the fight to do what is right that pleases God. The last one I want to mention is we need to always be mindful that the real measure of success in our lives is about our relationship with God. How we measure success in life is a very, very important question for each one of us. How do we keep score? Because it impacts how we conduct ourselves in the workplace. Needless to say, the secular world measures it by on the basis of somebody's net worth, their popularity ratings, who they know, their power base, and their worldly achievements. But for Christians, the answer to that question is totally different. Lots of verses to pick from, but the one I point you to is Jeremiah 9:23 through 24 that reads, "Let not the wise man boast of his wisdom, or the strong man boast of his strength, or the rich man boast of his riches. But let him who boasts boast about this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who exercises kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth. For in these I delight, declares the Lord." The takeaway here has always been for me when I had value choices in business is that a successful life of a Christian is not about what we've accomplished in our work lives. Instead, it is that we have had an ever deepening relationship with God. In sum, our success in the business world, whether it be fame, power, or money, does not compare in any way with the relationships that we have with God and the closeness that we have with God. Let me close with this thought. I always have when I enter a room, negotiations, this is speaking, not literally, but I always want to know where the exit is. I want to know how to get out of the room if there's trouble. And I can give you lots of stories, funny ones, about how I've had to do that. Sneak down an elevator shaft, do all those kind of things. But anyway, when you see you've got a problem, you want to get out of there. Well, I've just given you six things that have helped shape how I try to think when I go into the workplace every day, how spiritually I ought to be oriented. Okay, but there's got to be a safety valve when everything goes wrong. And let me give you my closing comments. We live in the fast lanes of Dallas, where the demands of our business careers can weigh us down to the point that our thoughts about God grow dim, very dim. We can find ourselves spiritually depleted, and that is when we are especially vulnerable to problems. I have found that the best antidote, for me at least, and I think for probably all of us, is that we have to stop and we have to think, slow down, and for me, I go drown myself in the immensity of God. I drown my thoughts. I drown my cares. I drown my anything that's pulling at me, tugging at me. I go drown it in the immensity of God. I've always turned to the same verse. We're all familiar with it. It's in Psalm 46:11. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am God. The phrase "be still" means to stop what you're doing and let go. Let go of your grip on the things that are holding you back so you can focus on what really matters. Know that I am God means to think deeply about who God is and to stop thinking about yourself. Why? It allows you to gain the right perspective on life, the right perspective on your business career, a right perspective on your worries, your concerns, and your problems, your heartaches. Because when you focus on God, you see things that put these other things pretty small on the list. You see it as infinite. while you see we're finite and he is infinite. You see that we are weak. He is all powerful. You see how little you know and he has perfect knowledge. You see how much he loves you, how much mercy he brings, and he keeps his promises that he's always with us. When we do that, our business life, our careers take on a different meaning, and we deal with them in the way that pleases God. Thank you.
Thus says God, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not revoke the punishment because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of the way. Ah, you who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is room for no one but you, and you are left to live alone in the midst of the land. Ah, you who make iniquitous decrees, who write oppressive statutes, to turn aside the needy from justice, and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be your spoil, and that you make the orphans your prey. I shout out, do not hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Announce to my people their rebellion, to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet day after day they seek me and delight to know my ways, as if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me righteous judgments. They delight to draw near to God. Look, you serve your own interests on your fast day and oppress all your workers. Look, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to strike with a wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose, a day to humble oneself? Will you call this a fast? A day acceptable to Yahweh? Is not this the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover them? If you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise from the night. Yahweh will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places and make your bones strong. And you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. If you refrain from trampling the Sabbath, from pursuing your own interests on my holy day, if you honor it, not going your own ways, serving your own interests, or pursuing your own affairs, then you shall take delight in God, and I will make you ride upon the heights of the earth. I will feed you with the heritage of your ancestors, Jacob, Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, and Zilpah, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. These are the words of various prophetic texts in the Hebrew Bible. They were composed more than 2,500 years ago in a time different from ours and spoken in a place far away from this one. The original writers did not know about our complicated world, our economic system, and our ways of dealing with the problems prevalent in the world today. They did not know of capitalism, the problems of nuclear proliferation, planes crashing into buildings, or, for that matter, the Christian faith. Yet they speak about God and God's relationship with God's people in ways that many in this country will find challenging. The prophetic texts imagine the relationship between God and people as a collective experience and practice, not as an individual concern. And God's presence is depicted as actively present. It is God who, quote, deals out justice to the oppressed. When the people of God feed the hungry, set prisoners free, loosen the bonds of injustice, undo the thongs of the yoke, let the oppressed go free. The prophetic poems articulate clearly, succinctly, and powerfully that to love Yahweh is to do justice to the poor and oppressed. Again and again, the poetry asserts that God wants justice, not sacrifices, and that there is a bond between the knowledge of God and interhuman justice. Hence, Gustavo Gutierrez, the founding father of Latin American liberation theology, wrote about these prophetic texts that I just read the following. Quote, to know Yahweh, which in biblical language is equivalent to saying to love God, is to establish just relationships among persons. It is to recognize the rights of the poor. End quote. Knowledge about God does not derive from worship, not from ritual, not from liturgy or inward directed prayer, the prophets say, but from the encounter with God in concrete actions toward others, especially the poor. Here's another prophetic text that makes this point, and I didn't add it on the handout on your table. It comes from Isaiah 1, verses 10 through 17, and I have only a selection. It says this, what to me is the multitude of your sacrifices, says Yahweh. I have had enough of your burnt offerings of rams and the fat of beasts. I do not delight in the blood of the bulls or of lambs or of goats. Remove the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil and learn to do right. Seek justice. Rescue the oppressed. Defend the orphan. Plead for the widow. Another liberation theologian, Jose Croato, made sure that we understand this message not only as a text composed 2,500 years ago, as the sacred text of Jewish and Christian faith. The Hebrew Bible is emphasizing, according to Croato, that those among the people who enjoy the privileges of power, and he says, and enslave others, whether through injustice or through the use of laws that are in their favor, they need to hear these texts. More specifically, Croato writes about Isaiah 58, quote, Isaiah's message is not directed to the people in need, but to those in society capable of freeing and nourishing the needy, precisely because they have the power to free others or the resources to aid the needy. Croato writes, the prophet's criticism is not directed against the common people, but against the upper socioeconomic classes. The prophets express a demand for justice. And Willy Schottroff, actually a German professor of Old Testament, whom I met in one course at the Frankfurt University many, many years ago, he wrote the following. In the encounter with God in the Bible, there is no salvation which is not foremost salvation for the poor. A society that aims to solve its economic and social problems on the back of poor people in its country and in the world, and does not stand in solidarity with the poor, as emphasized in Isaiah 58 and elsewhere, is not in contact with the God of the Bible. Even if this society is superficially religious and performs numerous and well-intentioned religious exercises. That's what you have to do when you are an Old Testament Bible scholar and you... So then I was asking myself this question. Who are the people today? The poor people. Have you ever been in a slum? I have. Once I stumbled into one in Egypt, in Cairo, backpacking, and we lost our way, and suddenly we were in this tent slum. There are many stories. I was just now in Argentina. We had a wonderful immersion trip during spring break in Buenos Aires. We didn't go to a slum there. We ran out of time, I guess, Robert Hunt. But I learned from that trip to quote Croato here for you. These very powerful, clear-cut, unambiguous words where the Hebrew prophets stand when it comes to justice. I have not much time to answer who are the poor people today, but let me give you an idea how I would go about answering it. I have your handout on your table there. One page comes from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The OECD was founded in 1961 and currently has 30 members. One of them is United States. Germany is also part on that list. I xeroxed the sheet, the chart, the gap between rich and poor in 2005, 5 years ago. 5 years ago was a long time ago. I think maybe it's worse today. But did you expect that in the that the United States would rank third in the largest gap between rich and poor after Mexico and Turkey in these 30 countries that are part of this group? And the BBC, I found, had this to say about the distribution of wealth in the United States. Quote, the United States itself also has the largest gap and inequality between rich and poor compared to all the other industrialized nations. When I was teaching at undergraduate liberal arts colleges and had the age group from 18 to 22, I always like to give data like this because I'm long enough in this country to know we think here it's fine. It's actually the best there is out there. And maybe that's true. We can debate this another time. But when you look at the numbers of rich and poor and inequality, I think we need to face up to these numbers. It is the largest gap and inequality between rich and poor compared to all the other industrialized nations. For example, the top 1% receives more money than the bottom 40%, and the gap is widest in 70 years. Furthermore, in the last 20 years, while the share of income going up to the top 1% has increased, it has decreased for the poorest 40%. I came to Dallas a couple of years ago, and by now I've experienced in my very close personal space two things that make me worried about Dallas. One is my car got broken in right out there in the night when I was actually in the office grading papers. The other is just 3 or 4 weeks ago, my neighbor's house got broken in, and I'm told this just happens all the time. That's a big city. It happens all. I lived in New York City. Okay, people get mugged there, but the break-ins in this town are tremendous. So I'm asking myself, why does this happen? It's a big city. I asked actually a police officer. You know, in the food stores, you have police officers there. Well, we have police officers there, and asked him why are there so many break-ins. He said exactly that. It's a big metropolitan area. I said, really? It seems kind of not so big when you compare it to Chicago and New York and even Boston. I have the answer now when I read who got the Pulitzer Prize last week or 10 days ago. You know that the journalist team of the Dallas Morning News did these editorials about the gap between South Dallas and the northern parts. I think that's why there are so many break-ins. People might have crazy things going on, and maybe then they break in here and there, but the number of break-ins and vandalizing cars and all these things must have something to do with poverty. Now, I also brought another handout that talks a little bit about the feminization of poverty. According to the statistics given there, most poor people are women. This is an article published in 2008, and it states that 70% of the world's poor people are women, and that the majority of the 1.5 billion people live on $1 a day or less, and these are women. This is staggering information. Even if we were to assume that the situation has improved today, but I seriously doubt it. So I wish to invite your comments about the unambiguous insistence of the prophetic literature that God is on the side of the poor and hence poor women. And if wealthy people want to be on the side of God, they have to work day and night to help the needy, oppressed, and disempowered. That at least is the position of the biblical witness, and a position that many mainline Christian denominations reiterate. Let me just mention that in 2007, the Lutheran World Federation's Assembly had this to say, quote, "As a communion, we must engage the false ideology of neoliberal economic globalization by confronting, converting, and changing this reality and its effects." And in 2004, when the World Alliance of Reformed Churches gathered for the 24th General Council, the delegates from around the world declared that working to create a just economy is essential to the integrity of the Christian faith. And they said this, these global delegates from around the world, they said, "We believe that the integrity of our faith is at stake if we remain silent or refuse to act in the face of the current system of neoliberal economic globalization." So the tension between business and faith is for real when we look at the biblical, prophetic, and Christian witness on the one hand and the contemporary economic situation in which we live on the other hand. Just remember, and that's the last page on your handout, what Lloyd Blankfein said in November of last year. He said, "We do God's work," when he defended Goldman Sachs' profit. And I don't know if you had time to read the New York Times today, but I did. They're on the front page today. And Krugman wrote an editorial on looters and loafers. Did you see that one? About the fraud and Goldman Sachs now actually being, if I say this correctly, charged for purposefully, intentionally creating mortgage products that were supposed to profit them and not those who were buying the mortgage deals. The tension is not easily resolved between business and faith. But the prophetic witness of the Hebrew Bible challenges Western societies to deal with it if, and that cannot be assumed or taken for granted, if we envision a society that favors economic justice more than economic exploitation. Of course, this is not a new tension. Welcome. The bibliography of the scholarly literature on your handout shows that we have looked, by we I mean we Bible scholars, we have looked at this problem for a long time. And I have much to say about this, but I won't because my time is almost up, but I thought, let me give them a reading list. Throw in a couple of articles that are not in English. And I had to because in the I have two sections. From the end of the 19th to the early 20th century, there was actually a push to deal with this issue of economics and the Bible. I'm a Hebrew Bible scholar, so what you find here is only Hebrew Bible stuff. I know there's a lot of New Testament work that has been done, but I'm Hebrew Bible. As I try to emphasize to my dear students, some of whom are present, we are doing Hebrew Bible. Don't mention the J word right now. So what you have here on your bibliography is the first major scholarly contribution to the topic of economics and Hebrew Bible, and a lot of this work at the time was done in German and in French. So here's a new opportunity to brush up on German and French. The second, since the 1980s, was another push to deal with the topic. And this is not a surprise if you know anything about the history of theological studies. Of course, in the 1980s, already beginning in the early 1970s, liberation theologies came into being. I mentioned Gustavo Gutierrez in my talk at the very beginning, who published his book, Theology of Liberation, in 1971 in Spanish. So that push of liberation theologians made Bible scholars also be very interested in the question of justice. So that's why, since the 1980s, you have a lot of material translated in English and originally written in English on the topic, and I gave you a selected list. So the question about the tension of faith and business is not a new one. It is one that we do not always want to talk about. This goes to deep convictions that we hold dear in society. But that's why it's great to be a Bible scholar, especially here at Perkins School of Theology, because I can actually deal with it. And now I even had the privilege of talking to you a little bit about this, and I thank you for your attention.
Very good. Thank you.
I suspect, like me, many of your heads are just bouncing full of ideas and questions and things. What we're trying to do is create a conversation and a dialogue. We want to take just a couple of moments before we end today to allow us as a gathered community to process some of the questions that may be coming up. So let's take a few minutes to have questions for Mike and Suzanne to respond to. If you have a question, raise your hand. I'm going to try to get a mic to you because we're recording, and we want to try to record the questions as well. Yes.
This is a question for Suzanne. Suzanne, I'm wondering if in your thinking you're distinguishing between justice and giving charity. Don Helmut Romero said that he was a saint when he was giving money to the poor, and he became the devil when he started asking how does society create the poor. And so I'm wondering, from a Hebrew Bible perspective, is there a distinction between charity and justice?
No, justice is the term used for charity. Justice.
Do you, in your own teaching and thinking, distinguish justice seeking from just giving charity?
I think justice is more radical. Justice goes to the. It's not an individualizing strategy. It is it requires to, when you read these prophetic texts, it requires a infrastructure reform, revolution, depending how far you want to go or where we are in the world. So the Hebrew Bible terminology uses justice. Now, some people say, when I do charity, I do justice. So this is a touchy issue. Very important question. But for the prophetic text, the text that I read in the beginning, they don't talk about charity. They're demanding justice for the poor. Now, they how do we get there is the question. Is charity enough? Who gives the charity? I mean, I think that's why I got a little scared today, thinking about my husband. Oh, wow, this is really the liberation theologians emphasizing justice. They are not satisfied with charity. It's not enough.
Another question. Yes. Let me come to you, Frank. All
right. My question is actually for both of you, but I'll start with Mike because, Mike, I know that the issue of education is of particular importance to you. And also, education has a material impact on poverty and what the opportunities are for those that aren't. So if I could get both of you to comment, Mike, with you starting, about how you see the role of business and of the marketplace in trying to encourage education for our youth, and then any other comment that you guys would both like to make about that.
Let me just speak from Texas and having been involved in Austin. The legislature will do the very, in my opinion, and I tell them to their face, and I've done it before, and that is they're going to do the least they can get by with because it's about raising taxes. And to raise taxes means they get voted out of office in their minds, and so it's very hard. I don't care if it's Democrats or Republicans. They're both the same. Both the same. However, because of the last, I'd say, 10 years, the progress has been made in adequately funding public schools in Texas has been because of the business community. Is that there's one thing, as I've explained to the people in my school district here, I said, we have power because we write checks and to people who run for office. And we need to, they listen to us. And if we don't fight for the poor school districts, we're making a huge mistake. So a lot of what business communities have done, powerful people in business, have really put a lot of pressure on the legislature. And as we all know, Texas now is ranked first or second, or at least second, I'd say, in equity in school funding. There's still an inadequacy of funding right now. Our firm filed a lawsuit on behalf of all the school districts in Texas, and we won one level of it, and we'll be doing that thing again to make sure that the public schools, particularly the disadvantaged, are taken care of.
I'm not
Great defense. Great defense.
I am into educating. I am always very disappointed about the effort to provide serious educational programs for adults, teenagers, and for children. So I am actually making my contribution by doing my best to help in our efforts to graduate future ministers that will implement and create educational programs in their churches that are worthy of intellectual praise. And I think this is a very serious question about the education system in the United States. And this requires serious debate. I know some people feel money is not everything and it doesn't matter. But I know that the educational system in Germany is costing a lot of money. They're also trying not to cut back because then we create all these major collective conversations, where we want to go as a society and so on. This is what we need in a serious way, and I'm so glad to hear that in Dallas their efforts to create some equity. I know that there is a lot of inequity when you have a school system that's basically financed by the tax collected in the area that you used to do. So, you know, I think serious theological education is more needed than ever. There are a lot of voices out there. It's just screaming. That doesn't only pertain, of course, to religious talk, but in general, and a lot of noisy noisemakers out there. And I devote my professional life to help future ministers to provide, to create the kind of churches that are intellectually, educationally serious and make a contribution this way to larger society.
Can I add one thing to that? In the context of the I use the word copping out, like getting the legislature to do it, get business people. We ran into several business people, big companies, who because they had a certain legislation that they wanted up at that time, would not take a stand with us because they were afraid of the repercussions. So they copped out on us. And that's this dilemma where you face, do you do what's pleasing to God or do you do what's pleasing to yourself?
I hope that this has created ideas, both raised new questions and inspired. Our covenant with you is to start on time and end on time. And that's my job, to make sure I hold true to that covenant. Some of you have other questions. If you'll hang around afterwards, Suzanne and Mike, can you hang around just a few minutes that folks may come up and visit with you and ask some of your questions? You may want to continue the dialogue at your table. I hope you'll take it back to your classrooms, to your workspaces, among your communities, and continue the dialogue. A couple of housekeeping matters. Please, if you would like to be invited to the event in September, leave your business card on the table or put it in one of the little fish bowls out on the desk or fill out one of these pieces of paper. This is an email invitation event only. We do not mail invitations because we're trying. Our goal has been to keep this free of cost by having sponsors, and we certainly appreciate those who have helped sponsor so that you could come. But therefore, we'll just do email invitations. So please make sure we have your contact information. We'll be sending that at the end of July, so you can get that on your calendars and invite others to come join us as well. Also, if you're here and you think you want to sponsor one of these events, catch me at the end. I'd love to talk to you about that. I promise not to twist your arm, but I'd love to give you that information. Any housekeeping items that we have left, Dean? Then I want to dismiss us, if I can, by saying grace and peace to you all, and thank you for your time and willingness to be here, and we are adjourned for the afternoon.